Welcome to Vulcan Hello, the Incomparable's only podcast dedicated to new Star Trek. I am one of your co-captains, because apparently co-captains are now a thing, Scott McNulty, and I am joined by Mr. Jason Snell, as always. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Scott. I wasn't able to be with you in person today, so instead I'm joining you as a holo.
Oh, very nice. Mm-hmm. Now, one of my notes, I knew this episode we were talking about Star Trek Discovery Season 4, Episode 2, Anomaly. Not the most exciting name, but, you know, it's...
That's what it's about.
That's what it's about. Yeah, exactly. It is what it is. It is about this anomaly.
What was that title again, Scott?
Anomaly? Is that not how you say anomaly? Oh, yeah. That's funny. But really, what we all know is Saru is coming back in this episode. So that's the exciting thing. And he does. He's back on the bridge. And the question, of course, well, I don't know if you had this question, Jason, but the question I had was, well, what is he going to do on Discovery? I assumed he'd be first officer, but is he going to, because he's a captain, is he going to, you know, lower his rank or what's going on? And we find out he's just going to captain who's going to be a first officer for another captain, which seems strange.
Yeah. Well, okay. So Star Trek is not without precedent here, right? Decker was, I guess he was demoted technically. Spock was a captain, but had Kirk run the ship in Star Trek II.
I feel like when you have two captains on a ship, one gets turned into a Commodore or something.
Well,
for that duration.
And and Scotty, remember, was the captain of engineering.
Oh,
of
that's
the Excelsior.
True.
So here's the thing with naval. I mean, it's first it's Star Trek, but it is captain is a rank, but captain is also a job, and so you end up in these scenarios where like Scotty has been advanced to captain rank, but he's not the captain of the ship, and so that's sort of what they're doing here. You know, it's Star Trek does this. It's fine. What I thought was amusing is that they needed to dispense with. I mean, they put Saru out and then they had to pull him right back in, which I find strange. We talked about this last season, like why do it that way? But they wanted to have him have a sort of a different perspective, and they needed to move him out of the way in some way so that they could make Burnham the captain. And in this, we get the dialogue where it's like, well, I know you were offered the captain of a ship. And he was like, yes, but I turned it down because this is where I want to be right now, which is fine. But like, they had to do that, right? They had to explain, like, no, he's choosing to be with Discovery, that this is the place he wants to be right now. And honestly, they came from the far past, and these are the only people he really knows in the present, other than the Kelpian Chamber of Commerce, I guess. And so here, you know, why not? It actually kind of makes sense. And they have there's that lovely scene where they're talking and Giorgio's telescope is there in the background from the wreckage of the Shenzhou, and them saying that they're, you know, they have this connection and he wants to support her in her, you know, first days as captain. And I think it's very clear that our policy on this podcast is Saru is the best. And so here he is being the best again and saying, hey, I'm going to do the best thing for this show and for Burnham and be on the bridge as a first officer.
He's a real team player. That's Saru doing the best for show. He's going to show up every time. Yeah, I mean, we love Saru, and it does. I am just happy he's back. I don't really care, but it was just a thing like, how are they going to get around this whole captain thing? And they're just like, well, we're not going to get around this captain thing. He's just captain. Deal with it, nerds.
He's ranked captain. He's not the captain of the ship. That's Burnham. He doesn't outrank her. She's in charge. He's not. He will be a captain somewhere else someday.
He'll get his own ship.
Right now, they got him here. It means that when she wants to go off and, you know, pilot a little busy bee or whatever they're called, there's a qualified captain there to take her place. Mm-hmm. That's helpful.
That's true. Although Star Trek first officers are notoriously bad for stopping their captains from doing very dangerous things that captains shouldn't be doing.
So. Well, this is the beauty of this scenario is Saru is actually, as a Star Trek configuration, I think it is perfect because Burnham is an action captain and Saru is more of the, you know, she's more of the Riker-esque, you know, because they took Kirk, and they sort of split him in two. And so she's Kirk-like or Riker-like, and Saru is more Picard-like. And so having him be there to guide the ship while Burnham is off, you know, on the planets somewhere punching a lizard or something, I don't know, that he's got the, you know, wise hand up on the ship. I think that's a good combination for Star Trek.
Yes. And we've seen it before, so that's the role Saru plays. And in this episode, he also asks some pertinent questions that he's like, well, maybe, are you sure you want to do that? Maybe, you know. And he asks it in a way that is supportive and in keeping with his role, unlike our previous episode where we had the president of the Federation just kind of hanging out.
She makes a bad first officer, the president of the Federation.
Does. Bad at you know, that. No, she's good at being a president, theoretically. We don't know yet. She's new. Although she does appear in this episode as well at the big Zoom meeting about the disaster. But not a great first officer. But yeah, but this episode starts with Book. His planet has been destroyed. Nobody cares about it except for him. But he's very sad, and he's having some issues. And I suppose this scene is really supposed to tell us, A, he's sad that everyone he knows in his planet has been destroyed. Okay, get that. He's seeing things, although it wasn't clear. I mean, later in the episode, it's clear that he's seeing things. At this point, you don't know if he's just, you know, remembering things, right, or if he is seeing things. And then I think it also serves to remind us, hey, remember, he and Michael Burnham are, they work together, but they're also in a relationship together. And she's, you know, trying to help him out. And he doesn't want her help at this moment. He just wants to be left alone, which she does not care for.
I think it's very hard to imagine being in a position of a character like Book, because it isn't just that he's lost people close to him, but he's lost his entire planet and his entire civilization, and they don't know if there are any, you know, what of the Kwajon were off-world, you know, but it's going to be a handful. It's a little bit like seeing the impact of the destruction of Vulcan on Spock in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie. But it is grief, and so on that level, you know, while it's sort of incomprehensible, it is still, you know, it's still grief. And so I think it's interesting that, you know, how do you process the unprocessable? And it's very difficult. And Burnham's got some knowledge of this because she lost her parents. I would argue, and this is one of the things that I wish the show would grapple with more, which is they've all got to be grieving or have recently grieved, because everybody on Discovery has lost everybody that they ever knew other than the crew of Discovery itself. So, you know, Burnham has a very recent bit of grief, which is she had to leave her brother behind. And, you know, everybody they know is long dead now. And I wish that had been more of the conversation, because, you know, although it doesn't help other than to say, I understand you, in a way, I understand your grief. And I don't know. It's interesting that this episode is grappling with a lot of emotional issues. I mean, I think when we will come to remember it as the episode where gravity gets all weird, plus also people have serious emotional conversations, because those are the two things that happen sometimes simultaneously.
Yes. Oh, those gravity scenes were really good, but we're skipping ahead. But yeah, I mean, it's a lot of people talk about grief in this episode, which is appropriate. And they do kind of mention that, hey, we are all grieving. And I think what Culbert says, you know, people grieve in different ways and people get through it. I think Saru also says this, people deal with grief in different ways. So you have to, you know, give them space and give them what they need.
Unfortunately, sometimes they also need to fly a dangerous mission to save the galaxy. You see, that's the problem.
And that's why you don't want to be the captain of a starship, although you have to make these decisions.
They do give him the room. That's the funny thing, is they're like, we'll just have Detmer fly your ship. And he's like, no. But like, they're giving him the space to be like, yeah, I'm going to go to the holodeck and you know, be sad for a while. But instead, he's like, no, I want to do this. And honestly, you know, you and I both lost a parent in the relatively recent past. And like, sometimes you want to be active and do something. And sometimes you don't, but I identified with Book being like, no, like I want to be useful. And this is the thing that basically caused my grief. So if I can help us solve this problem, I want to do that. I get that. Unfortunately, he is also hallucinating. So yeah,
that is a problem. Well, no. And I thought it was really, I bought it as, you know, we know Book from all of last season or most of last season. I forget when he was introduced. But I thought this was a really good character episode, right? So yes. I think that the way Book acted seemed to ring true to me in that he's grieving, but he also knows that this job needs to get done. He thinks he's the only person who can do it. And so he is willing to, you know, he's like, I can do it. I'm not going to tell anyone I'm hallucinating because then they won't let me do it.
Which is not what usually happens with grief, by the way. You don't usually have hallucinations. But
he also has these powers, right? Yeah. So yeah. So one imagines maybe he's, I don't know what he's going to. And I also love the pairing of him and Stamets, two characters who really never really talk to each other, which they of course talk about in this episode because they have to talk to each other and interact. And Stamets is going through grief and multiple levels of grief, right? Because he's grieving. They've lost everyone. He had that whole situation with Culper dying and coming back and very complicated. Also him, which is something I never thought of, but they bring up in this episode, him losing the uniqueness that was being the only person who could do the spore drive, right? And so that's a lot of layers there. And
carrying the guilt that it's Book who ultimately is the one who saves his family, whereas Stamets is like too valuable and gets ejected by Burnham, which is made into kind of a too soon joke here, which is kind of funny. But yeah, like you put these two characters that don't seem to have anything in common and haven't really spent time together and that naturally might be very grumpy toward one another and in general, and you have them kind of push off against each other, but also come to some understanding. I thought that was really well done as the episode progresses, that they, you know, they make themselves useful. And there's a moment where he says, you can leave. And he says, I'm not leaving. It was a really good series of scenes with those two actors who have not spent a lot of time together.
Yes, I enjoyed their interactions. And so they have to fly into this anomaly so that they can scan. It's like a very Star Trek-y thing. Yeah, and there is
to scan it.
We skip over a scene that I think, so I feel I'm interested to know what you think of this, Jason, but I feel like this episode is leading us down the path that this is kind of a unknown, naturally occurring thing, theoretically naturally occurring, and they have to just try and figure out how to fix it or warn people, and that's what the season's about. Hopefully they're not going to, once again, hopefully they won't find a Gorn in subspace has caused this. But
what did I say? Somewhere it's like Tilly's, like it turns out that Tilly's cousin... it's like, no, that's not what it's going to be. But no. I mean, obviously this is kind of pandemic influenced, and it's influenced by a lot, as Star Trek often is, of current events. And the idea here, the theme that we all need to pull together in order to protect the whole from something that threatens all of us, I think is you mentioned that last time, is absolutely what's going on here. We get that scene where the president of Navarre says, you know, we'll use our science, and they were so standoffish last season, and they're like, no, we'll help. We'll analyze your data if you collect it, which is presumably we're going to get some more of Navarre. Maybe they will even go there. And so definitely you're seeing that whole thing, that this is they think it's a pair of black holes, and they go there and they're like, I like that scientific aspect of this storyline, which is, I saw somebody on the internet say, does anything happen in this episode? And I'm like, well, they have to gather the data, right? Like part of Star Trek is this sort of science and exploration, which is we have to go see it and understand what it is and try to figure out the mystery. And that starts with putting yourself in the case of the Discovery in harm's way and having to get thrown up against the ceiling and back down on the floor and all that, which is very spectacular, even though there are apparently flamethrowers on the bridge. My headcanon is there the flame guides to get the flames away. They should probably not have flammable things. And also rocks that keep falling, which I kind of headcanoned away as programmable matter that gets knocked around and kind of turns into kind of like rocky stuff that just lays on the ground. But it was spectacular. But the idea is the danger is there because they're trying to gather this information and learn. And they, at first glance, they know that it doesn't look like they thought it would theoretically. And so it's a deeper mystery. And whether it turns out to be natural or caused by something, it's essentially a natural disaster at this point. It's a big space hurricane that is going to do a lot of damage, and they got to figure out, you know, either how to stop it or where it's going, because that's the bigger revelation at the end of the episode, is it seems to change direction. So how do we even plot a course? We can't evacuate solar systems. Probably can't do that anyway, but we can't even try if we don't know where it's going next. And so we all have to pull together and try to figure this one out. That's the theme. Also, did you notice the nod to the first scene in the cage in this episode? Well, I saw somebody on Twitter, since we're doing this a little bit later than we usually do, I've seen some people comment on this, and somebody said it's a little bit weird, or maybe this was in Slack, it's a little bit weird that they get there and there's nothing there, and then they change the view, and then you see something, and it's just stuff that's floating around, and you're not meant to understand what it is other than there's a big thing out there, and it's scary. But in order to make it visible, essentially, Burnham says polarize the view screen, basically, like polarize spectrographic, blah, blah, blah. I think that's the first thing that Pike says in the cage. Or one of the first things he says is pull. So this is a classic Trek moment of like, I don't see a thing. Well, do a thing to the screen. And they're like, oh, okay.
There it is.
I think it's a very early thing that happens in the cage, as you polarize the viewer or something like that. But it's classic Star Trek kind of stuff.
I did think it was funny because they made a point earlier of saying black holes are really hard to detect, and then they show up and they, you know, they just change the polarization. There it is.
Well, I guess if you know where it is, you can go see it, but you can't
put on the right glasses.
If you're not looking, they're just kind of out there moving around, which is good. I think there was a good mix. I was thinking about whoever the science consultant is for this show, that like, I thought it was a good mix of things we know about science and ridiculous Star Trek science kind of put together. Like they mentioned dark matter at one point, and they mentioned coalescing black holes, which is a real thing. So that I thought they mixed in a bunch of kind of like real sciencey stuff with their layer of, you know, Star Trek science on top, that I thought that was kind of fun. And at the end we get that picture that is, you know, obviously it's not we're seeing it, but you can't see it with your eyes maybe, but they see it with their polarized viewer. But we get that moment where it pulls back and you get the sense of the enormity of it, and that the light is warping around it like a black hole. If you've seen Interstellar, that is one of the classic kind of like visualizations of what a black hole would look like, and they do that kind of thing here. It's a gravitational bubble and it's bending light all around it, and there are a bunch of planets in the way, and what's going to happen. And it's a good balance of the some real science with the fake Star Trek science.
I agree. And of course they could, I mean, they wouldn't, it has to be an entertaining episode of Star Trek as well. So, you know, them spending 40 minutes trying to find out where this black hole is would not be all that interesting.
Or if they get there and they're like, all right, let's everybody press record. And then they're sitting there like just drinking coffee while they're waiting for the data to come in. And then they leave. Also not much of a Star Trek episode.
No. We know there's going to be some trouble. And so they have to get in closer to do that. And so that's the A plot. Then there's the... I don't even know if it's a B plot, but a segment of the story, which is Gray getting to preview his potential new body.
Yes, Gollum body.
Mm-hmm.
Gollum body using the Soong method.
Using the Soong method, just like some ancient, some historical Starfleet admirals named... Picard?
Yeah.
Is that how you say it? Picard?
Yeah. They tried, Culber tries really hard not to, like, just go, Picard! He's like, no, I've never heard of this guy. It's hundreds of years ago. We have no idea who that guy is. Nobody knows him. He's just a footnote, but I do know his name, but he's just a footnote.
He was a robot.
What I find about that, okay, so it's interesting because they're like, okay, did everybody become immortal then and just use synth bodies after that? And they're like, no, it didn't work as reliably and it fell out of use. So it's like, okay, that's a way that we can explain that people don't
check.
Just move into synth bodies. It's probably all for the best. What I came out of it, and this is not necessarily true, there may be that there are whole planets of synth people out there. I mean, Picard suggests that that is the case, and there's nothing to believe that that isn't the case. But I just find it funny that it may be that in the 31st century, the only Soong who's known is Alton Inigo Soong, who created the Golem, and not Noonien Soong, who created the data androids. Like, is that right? Like, that's kind of funny. If it turns out that the synth bodies thing was a more fruitful path than like making sentient androids like data.
Well, but, maybe in this context, the Soong you mentioned.
Yeah, and Star Trek Picard really,
this person.
Really does suggest that the synths are going to be ongoing, like they're just life forms now in the universe. Mm-hmm. But and there's nothing to contradict that in Star Trek Discovery. So, but it's yet another Picard Discovery link, just like how they picked up the warrior nuns.
Mm-hmm. It's all related.
I guess it's Star Trek.
It's what? And this is nice because, you know, we get to see, oh, the he's going to get a body. He can get rid of that mole he doesn't like. And, you know, Adira and Gray are happy because this is going to happen, but they're also like, this big thing is happening that's imperiling the galaxy. And so, like, how happy can you be when everyone else is suffering?
This was the most pandemic moment, right? Which is, how do you feel happy when something bad is going on? I feel guilty about being happy. And that's, I mean, so many of us have experienced that at some point, right? Which is, it's a little weird, right? Like, if you have anything that's good or happy, when it feels like everything around you is terrible, it's kind of, you do get this form of, of almost survivor's guilt of like, should I express my happiness? Or, and Culber's like, being a good dad here, taking the long view, basically saying, you know, you need to treasure these moments, you know, life goes on. Don't punish yourself because you feel happy.
Yes, and that's another theme of this episode, right? Is the briefness of our lives and how, because I think Tilly and Saru have a conversation about this as well, right? And Saru says, another good dad here telling you know, how we choose to spend our moments in the time we have is what matters. So talking to Tilly about that, because I think that once again, we have another couple of scenes where Tilly is kind of questioning what she should be doing with her life. Should she be on Discovery? Should she be doing something else? Who knows?
Yeah, and it's, I'm unclear where they're going with this, other than she wants to talk to Culber and she wants to have a little sort of, like, they're going to talk through a little therapy, which is good. I think that this one, aside the people, you know, having gravity thingies, throwing them up and down in their spaceship, the other thing that happens here is that there's a lot of kind of talk about mental health and about, like, there's a lot of emotional kind of storyline stuff. And with Tilly, what I think is interesting is, I don't know where they're going with her storyline, but I really liked the fact that she has her management issue with Adira, where she tells them, like, you got to snap out of it. You got to focus here, right? Which is, in the moment, she probably does need to snap at them, but she's also concerned about it. And, you know, it doesn't help that her, you know, one of her dads is hanging around for that. But, and then she gets some advice, and she does better at the end, in a moment that really resonated with me, that moment where at the end of this, Tilly says to Adira, basically, you did good, kid. And I think there's something to that about, like, your gruff, kind of mad at you boss tells you did a good job. And you're like, wow, I wasn't expecting that. And I thought that was really good. And that Tilly then gets the follow up from Saru, where she's beating herself up about this. And Saru is like, you know, you're actually good at this, and you think you're an imposter, but you're not, because you're worried about it. Like, that's because you're good at it that you're worried that you're not good enough. And that's a real thing too. So I liked the, we could quibble about, like, how much management training there is in the middle of the gravitational anomaly disaster, but I thought it was good stuff.
Yes. And I mean, you know, much like this episode is telling us, right? Life goes on. Multiple things happen at the same time. So yes, people are dealing with this huge gravitational anomaly, but you still have to, you know, make sure your subordinates are doing their jobs and making sure that they're feeling appreciated and all that good stuff. And the problem with, Adira is that they are so used to, they're a genius. And so they are, as we see, so many Star Trek characters are geniuses who are not really used to working together on a team or having someone say, because basically what Tilly says is, did you check the whatever this variable or something?
Right.
And Adira's like, of course I did. And then that's when Tilly snaps and say, no, you don't get to do that. We double check and we triple check everything.
Right.
Which, and then Adira is sad.
Well, because, and I don't know if Tilly's a genius, but Tilly is really, really, really sharp, right? And so there's that too, which is, she's your boss and she understands this stuff. She's got more experience with it than you do. So you probably should listen to her, but, you know, but Tilly's struggling with, like, that. I thought that moment was really real and human and good in a way that you would actually have if you had people in Star Trek, right? Like, regular human beings in a Star Trek story, there would be moments like this. So I thought that was pretty well done.
Yes. And as someone who works with a lot of technical people who know a lot more about subjects than I do, but then I have to ask them questions, it was very true to form as well, because I say, you know, I have been in that situation on both sides, really. Not that I'm saying I'm a genius, but there are things that I know about. And then people ask questions and you think, well, why are you questioning my knowledge? I know this. And so it just, it was very relatable for me on both sides. I also laughed out loud because so Saru gets on, comes back. This is, well, it's something that Tilly says. So that's what I'm saying. He comes back and I thought to myself, is Saru taller? Because he looks incredibly tall next to everybody.
Yeah. Right. And then Tilly asks him, are you taller or did we just forget how tall you were? And I was waiting for him to say, oh, the boots are taller now. They make the boots taller now. But I guess he's supposed to, I mean, they're not, he wears shoes, but I guess he's got hooves. Maybe his hooves have grown. I don't know. I think that they just wanted to have that shot where Tilly, who's so much smaller than Saru, is walking next to him. And it's just kind of a funny little quirky moment. It's a very Tilly kind of moment. Like, did you get taller?
The other Tilly moment is when she asks Culper about, you know, she's sheepishly asking him about counseling services. And then he's like, of course, whenever. And then she has that, you know, that moment where she's like, well, he says, go back to saving the universe. And she, you know, answers in a funny voice and kind of just walks off, you know, awkwardly. And I just thought that was a great interaction as well.
Yeah, that's our Tilly. She's like that. I wanted to mention Burnham has a holodeck in her quarters.
Ah, yes.
Which is, I mean, captain's prerogative. There are probably holodecks all over the place now, right? But they come from an era where there weren't holodecks, right? So now you could have holodecks pretty much anywhere. And I was thinking, because somebody pointed out, but it's in her quarters and aren't people going to trip over the furniture? And it's like, it's programmable matter, folks.
Right, it just
like,
goes away.
I think it's essentially, like you said, everything's a holodeck. Like when it's showing you the actual setting, all of that matter is probably, I mean, not all of it, but you could have furniture that can be whatever you want it to be. And that's with programmable matter plus a holodeck, you can kind of do whatever you want. The only thing in there that can't be messed with is probably like mementos, like the telescope. But like her couch can go and come and go and it's fine. But it also was funny because it's like Saru walks in and it's a very kind of holodeck like door opening thing. And I was like, oh, the holodeck, because we haven't really gotten a lot of that in modern, you know, up to date Star Trek outside of Lower Decks, I guess, because Discovery didn't come from an era with a holodeck and Picard hasn't done a whole lot with that. So
he's busy fighting Romulans and things. So he can't
stuff like that. Yeah. So that was fun. That was fun.
And she's there because she's, you know, seeking her own solitude and trying to figure out how to help Book and all this stuff. And so she goes to, you know,
to Navarre. Place she went as a kid in Vulcan, which is a fun.
And I thought it was nice.
Little bit. And I think using their LED wall to its fullest there too, to have these swooping camera moves and, you know, all those things where, you know, it's a big panorama that they're in. And also I thought perfect use of the LED wall for a holodeck, because even if it looks a little bit fake, it's a holodeck.
It's a holodeck. Exactly. They so make it look a little fake so you don't think that it's the real thing.
Don't fall off the edge of the cliff.
That's my headcanon.
Yeah, that's, I love it. And right after that we get Zora. So just in the ongoing story of them inching closer to that Calypso short trek, the AI from the sphere data merging with the Discovery computer has now not only had the name or the voice that we heard in that short trek a few years ago, but now she has named herself Zora. Mm-hmm. That's the Discovery computer, which, you know, Saru is like, oh, did that happen? Okay. Well, I was gone.
It seems, I feel like they don't make a big enough deal about that as someone who would be living and working on this ship that has not been sentient before.
Yeah,
it's, and now seems to be.
I mean, I guess when you go 900 years into the future, you got to roll with the punches.
I guess that's true.
But this is something that's like maybe even out of bounds for that era that this thing has got, because it's got all that sphere data in it. But it does help. I agree. I think they should probably do a little bit more with that, but I think they're saving it. But it does help in the kind of why does the Discovery do this question that you have on a show like this, which is like, isn't there a whole Federation? Isn't there a whole Starfleet? I know they're not as big as they used to be, but why does Discovery have to do everything? And having that like sphere data thing where they've got this unique computer data source and the spore drive gives them a real good 1-2 punch of only Discovery can do this, which is very useful because otherwise you have to come up with some reason why it's all, the Enterprise is the only ship in the quadrant, right? So these between the sphere data and the spore drive, they've got reasons why they're sending these people, these fossils from 900 years ago out to do important missions.
Well, and they're also, as we talked about in the last episode, the Discovery crew is probably the most seasoned and well-trained Starship crew in their time frame,
They haven't had the Starfleet Academy for 100 years, so probably the standards on other ships aren't as good. Or they are an injection of like peak Federation to a sort of a sad, broken Federation, so there may be like perfect. That's why I think that you could argue in if you weren't making a TV show that the Discovery crew ought to be like dispersed throughout the fleet, and maybe maybe that is sort of what they're implying by them building new ships and stuff, is that that they will probably be instrumental in kind of the bringing back of the Federation over time, but they're not quite there yet. In general, I've enjoyed when they sprinkled in the 31st century tech. One of the things by doing, not only are they free of canon, right, which was the thing that I think we were excited about, that they no longer had to avoid contradicting canon things by jumping way ahead in time, but it also allows them to invent new sci-fi technology without worrying about it. It's not just canon, but it's just sort of like they're free to invent new tech and drop it on you and say, we have this thing now, and you've never heard about it in Star Trek before, but that's okay because we've never been this far forward in time. And so you get the not just the Hollow that Stamets is sort of virtually on book ship with him for most of this episode, but the Tether, which is some, is it an energy beam? Is it particles? Is it a little bit of both? They attach this little glowy tether to book ship so that they can pull them out. It's like a tractor beam rope thingy. And I love it. I love that it's not really explained.
It doesn't need to be. It's a, they tie a string to the back of the ship and
Goes it's
on.
Like a magic energy string that's like a tractor beam. And it's like, that's cool because that's, you know, something invented in the last 800 years that we haven't seen on Star Trek before. And it solves a plot problem in the episode of how do we make it so we feel like we can pull him back. I really like that. I think that's one of the benefits of pushing the show back out into the future is that they can use this, they can invent new cool whizzy sci-fi tech and just throw it at us. I think that's fun.
And that could be, I don't know if this is true or not, but it could be a reference to Enterprise as well, because in Enterprise, that Enterprise didn't have tractor beams, obviously, but it had grappling, I think they called them grapplers, which were basically grappling hooks on ropes that they shot at things and connected themselves to, so they could be hearkening back to that. But this one is much more advanced and apparently can stretch very far. And they don't actually use it to pull back bookship,
but when they disengage it, it comes back almost all the way to the ship as like an energy thing, and then it kind of breaks up into little particles and goes back in, which is like, what was that? I don't know. It was cool.
That's all you need.
Also, Burnham has a cone of silence.
I wanted to talk about that. I thought that was like my favorite new thing on the bridge, because I always thought to myself, as the captain, or anyone on the bridge, well, mostly as the captain, you're having conversations on the view screen with, and everyone is like, you're just on speakerphone all the time.
Yeah.
So what if you need to, you know, secretly confer with someone, or in this case, have like a very personal, like, you know, one-on-one, as, you know, take off your captain's insignia and say, listen, I'm worried. You need to get back here. And they say, all right, well, now there's a cone of silence. So a little force globe appears and,
yeah, it's good. Talk. It makes sense, right? The captain needs to have privacy for a moment, for whatever reason. and they've got the tech to do that. And yeah, she just gets a little sphere around her.
And I suppose she could walk to the ready room and take it there, or her
office. They're,
or whatever,
they're in a little tactical moment. And so to have that ability, and again, it's like a little sci-fi thing that, you know, I'm not sure we've ever seen anything like that before in Star Trek, but it doesn't really matter. Like, it makes sense. And why would you not? Like, part of the joy of Star Trek is you get in these moments where it's like, we have tech for that. And instead of having to come up with some sort of like bizarre plot contrivance about how things work, you can just say, let's say there's a privacy mode and you can invent it. And like in the earliest days of Star Trek, whenever you're out there on the edge of, and don't have to worry about like the continuity and the, of the franchise and stuff like that, you just invent stuff like that. And I feel that freedom right now with Discovery, where they can just toss all this stuff in there. And it's a little, it reminds me of some other sci-fi, like I was going to say, it's a little like Doctor Who or some other stuff like that, where you get these moments where stuff just gets tossed off and you're like, wait, what? where somebody has an inventive idea that they need in order to solve a problem, and then just say, well, you can do this. And it's fun to see Discovery doing that.
Yes. And I mean, Star Trek also has a long legacy of this kind of thing, even right from the whole transporters, right? They needed transporters because it was cheaper. It was too expensive to film shuttlecraft going up and down.
You name it, transporters, sensors, tractor beams, deflectors. I do have an issue with how Discovery displays the deflectors, because I always envisioned the shields and the deflectors as being like all those rocks. This is two episodes in a row where the rocks kind of like still hit the ship. And I'm like, shouldn't they get like pushed away? Isn't that what they like slide to the side? Like you've got a little bubble, but maybe that's less dramatic than they still hit you, but it doesn't hurt as bad. I'm not quite sure how that works. But yeah, they've been inventing this stuff. I guess that's what I'm saying is, once you're kind of like stuck canonically, you're right, stuck using the tools that are already there, and now they're sort of free to just invent new things and say, yeah, we figured that out in the last 800 years. There's now a cone of silence, just like there was on what Get Smart or something in the
yes, exactly.
60s.
Yeah, and they don't have to deal with, and I'm just going to repeat what you're saying, but you know, one of the problems we had with the first season, or not us in particular, but when I say us, I mean Star Trek nerds, is that Discovery had all kinds of systems that nobody, like the hologram communication array thing. Like, why do we never see this again? And it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And of course, it's just a TV show. You should just relax. But when you are, and we talked about this a lot, the first season of Discovery, like when you set your show in a period before another period that we know a lot about, there are certain, you know, things that as a viewer you expect, and if you aren't going to play by those rules, then it feels kind of like, well, why are you setting it in this time period?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why they had to have the whole thing where Pike is ripping out the holograms from the Enterprise, because he thinks that they make their bad mojo, and it's like, well, this ship's never gonna have holograms again. You're like, see that, fans? You see what we did there? And now they don't have to worry about that stuff. I enjoy it. Happy. I think that it's that they've made the choice to go so far, again, so far in the future, that's kind of ridiculous. Like the culture would be completely different, and it's like it's too far. But I think for Star Trek purposes, they just want it to be out far and away, so that they can be in clear air, where they can just kind of go wherever they want, and they don't have to worry about treading on existing canon, and they can play with it as much as they want. I'm very happy about that. Also, and kite
Ferengi
surfing
look different. Kite surfing, yes. Ferengi look different. All kinds of things happen in the future.
Yeah, yeah. I like Reese gets his moment where he's like, "Oh yeah, I've kite surfed on whatever. Well, let's just do that." And that's a fun little give somebody else on the bridge crew a solution to the problem of how are we going to save Book in the end. And
right, yes, there is a navigation falls and breaks, and he can't get out.
Right, and there's a Ferengi in the Zoom meeting at Starfleet headquarters. So it's good to see.
They doesn't get to say anything, but looks
yeah. But
horrified.
They named a ship after Nog, right? So this is obviously Nog was a trailblazer for.
So one assumes, I don't know if this is true or not, but one assumes that perhaps, well maybe Ferenginar is part of the Federation now.
Maybe
we'll
so.
Find out. I'm assuming that we are going to get a whole lot of Ferengi episode, much like Deep Space Nine. You know, every fifth Deep Space Nine episode was a Ferengi episode. So
interesting.
I'm going to assume this season of Discovery is when they're going to start doing that.
We're finally going to get our Ferengi episode at last. Mm-hmm. At last.
Some kind of kooky hijinks is going to happen.
It's the Ferengis and the Andorians and the... Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a flashback episode where the Federation president explains how she's got a half Cardassian, half Bajoran mother and a human father. And it turns out that the Ferengi were involved in some... some hijinks back in the 29th century. And
yes. It all happened on this obscure space station, Deep Space Nine. Yeah. I remember it well. That's not going to happen.
1,000-year-old space station called Deep Space Nine.
If the wormhole is still open, one assumes that Deep Space Nine is still...
Well, it's probably like Deep Space 900 now, but...
Oh, that is true. And now they have a spore drive. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't
matter. So if you, for whatever reason, I don't know who you are who does this, but if you haven't watched the episode of Discovery, but you do listen to this podcast and you're wondering, what happened to Book and his ship? Is he okay? He's fine.
He's fine.
He gets off well. They get the data that they need. And the big reveal at the end of the episode is that... you know, the whole reason they were there is they want to plot the course of this anomaly so that they can theoretically attempt and probably fail, but attempt to evacuate entire solar systems.
Right. But it moved.
But it moved in a different way than they expected. So the data, one assumes there's still valuable data there, but the purpose that they were gathering it for is now kind of meaningless because they don't really understand.
Right.
Why it moved. Assume it moved because in reaction to Discovery doing something.
Yeah, that's a possibility, is that it's actually reacting to stimuli of some kind. And maybe it's maybe it's like a big space amoeba, like in the immunity syndrome. Maybe not. So Book at the end too, I think Book basically, who has not been crying and has been really bottled up and acting weird with Burnham, he finally kind of lets his emotions out. And so that's his sort of like, that's his emotional arc for the episode, is after all of this nonsense is said and done, where he's risked his life and his ship and all of that. And Grudge, of course, his cat, who he has to pick up and put in her carrier before he goes in on an adventure, which was very fun.
Yes.
She doesn't like hollows because they don't smell.
Why don't you leave her on the Discovery? But anyway, that's not
Yeah, there. Well, I don't think they want her there. I think there's a sort of a, no. I mean, Burnham should
no
really
cats allowed,
allow that. There's no cats. The hair gets in everything. It gets in the replicators.
Also,
it may eat Ensign Tribble. So
that's true.
We don't
protect him at all costs.
Yeah, she's gonna eat Ensign Tribble. So he comes back and he finally kind of lets it all out, and that's he's progressing in his grief and all of that. And I'll just say again, I don't want to be flippant about him, but I'll just say again, boy, the destruction of Quajon really would have hit harder if they had done a good job of establishing that as a planet with like stuff and people on it. And they did such a bad job. And I feel like they got to be kicking themselves. Maybe they don't see it this way, but I just feel like they had two opportunities to establish Quajon and really get us a sense of Book. And I don't think they ever did. So part of it, it's like, maybe not, but still we can feel for Book at least and his pain. And David Ajala is a really good actor, and that's a fun character. And he gets a lot of time to shine in this episode. And I think it's one of the highlights of the episode is all the stuff with Book.
Yes. And I kind of feel like, as I was watching once again, not to be flippant about this, but in Star Trek, a lot of people have suffered through their planets being destroyed. Mm. So you feel like they would have like some kind of, so your planet's been destroyed, yeah, like tip sheet or something that you could go through to help with your grief.
Yeah. Culber's been reading that book, so he can do some therapy.
Exactly. Or let your coworkers, you know, some tips and tricks about, you know, maybe not mention that the reason that there are big rocks that you're flying through is because they are the planet of the person who's piloting the ship.
That's that moment of like, oh, Alderaan. Oh no. Nobody mention Alderaan to Princess Leia. It's not right now. One other thing I wanted to mention, just because we mentioned in passing a couple of times, but in the grand tradition of Star Trek shaking the camera and shaking the ship and having sparks go off and stuff like that, this gravitational wave effect where they get thrown up in the air and then come and smash down and all of that, that was great. It looked great. It was different. It was weird. I do think that they need to invest in seatbelts.
I did think that as well. I will say, when it happened, I was expecting the normal people are going to fly around, and that is not what happened. So I was like, whoa, I was not expecting them all to float up and kind of just hover there and then fall down. I did like, you know, when she asked the computer, Zora, when is this going to end? And the computer says, approximately now. And then they fell down. I was like, haha, that's funny.
Yeah, he says, like, in 2 seconds. And they're like, brace. I'm like, well, I don't know what they thought they were bracing, but it didn't do anything. And they just flew back. up into the air. So don't put on your seatbelts, people.
Put on your seatbelts. Didn't they have seatbelts? Some ship had seatbelts in Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah, we've seen it. I mean, the Enterprise franchise. Has it in the J.J. Abrams movies, but I think we saw it in a Star Trek show, too. And I don't know. You just... That's something. If you're going to get frequently thrown up in the air, you should probably have some sort of seatbelt or something.
And now it's all programmable matter, so they have no excuse. They could just add the seatbelts.
Yeah, just sip it right over there. Right when there's a wave coming, just strap everybody in momentarily.
Not as dramatic for the viewer, but
that's true.
And yes, you're right. There is way too many flammable things on the bridge, apparently.
Yeah.
I feel like they are... Now, this is a trope that people who watch science fiction and who make science fiction are well aware of, this whole, like, why are all the panels
on fire,
exploding, and fire
sparks
everywhere.
And fire, yeah.
And so I'm assuming that they just were like, we know it's ridiculous, but it looks cool, so let's just dial it up to an even more ridiculous level and have, you know, as you said, like flamethrowers going off in the
sort
walls.
The part that gave me pause is that there are a couple of shots where not only are there flames, but you can literally see that there's like a flamethrower like channel, like the nozzle of the flamethrower that is shooting out fire. And it's like, well, don't put that on the bridge. That seems like a
poor design choice,
a bad idea. But yeah, I mean, it wants to be exciting and all, and you know, it's amazing given all of the fire and sparks that you have in your 31st century technology. Yet everything still works afterward. Yep. More or less.
Nobody was really all that hurt. So
No. In fact, I actually do think hurling people up in the air and having them fall and smash against furniture, that's actually, that feels to me better in the sense of being like, wow, yeah, you could really get hurt. Like they use something we didn't mention. They use the little medical, Culper has this little like healing thing that he has to, everybody's got like wounds from smashing into their furniture. And I thought, well, that's good. Like that gives you some sense that the crew is really, being damaged by these waves as they're hitting the ship, and it's not just the ship but the crew inside that's being wounded. I thought that was effective. There were a lot of sparks and a lot of debris flying around for the bridge of a starship. You'd think it would be maybe a little bit more together.
I'm sure they had the debris so that it could also float up and be like, ooh, look, it's wacky, and then it would all rain down and it's very dramatic. But yeah,
but maybe replace your cottage cheese ceiling with something that's a little less debris.
But I will say, despite it making little sense to have those things in a functioning starship as a set piece, it looked really good.
It did. That's why they did it.
I enjoyed it.
That's why they did it, just because it looked really cool and was fun, and it was. It was. And afterward, other than seeing the actual kind of orifice from which the flames shoot out, where I thought, you should probably hide that a little bit instead of having built, like, we built the flames into the set this time. Like, really? But I would say overall, I like this episode. And I think the mixture is a very modern Star Trek mixture of kind of action and suspense with character stuff. I think there were moments where the character stuff was maybe not as artfully integrated into the rest of it as it could have been. But overall, I feel like this is sort of a quintessential Star Trek Discovery episode where it's about feelings and it's about people's progression and also about a giant gravitational anomaly. Like that is their take on modern Star Trek. And I think it's a pretty reasonable take on what a modern Star Trek show should behave like in terms of mixing the kind of more realistic, naturalistic understanding of characters and their feelings and who they are as human beings with the big widescreen, anomaly that threatens the galaxy kind of Star Trek stuff.
I agree. And it looked great as well. The anomaly, the debris or the accretion disk, all of that looked great. And, you know, as we belabored probably too long, the floating was great as well. So I think that this is another solid episode of Discovery. And we'll see. I have no idea where we're going in the next episode, but we'll find out next week, I suppose, when it airs. I don't even know the name of it. Let's see what the name. Maybe
episode 3.
Choose to Live is the name of the title. I don't know what that means, but we'll find out.